On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Issues and Options in Human Health Risk Assessment, a resource when alternatives to default parameters and scenarios are proposed. Today's training was developed by the ITRC Resources Team. We're going to introduce you to a document that's the basis of today's training, and we do hope that you can use our RISC-3 guidance document after the training class. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to serve as a moderator. I'll cover introductory material in the next few slides, and then turn the presentation over to our trainers from the ITRC Risk Assessment Team. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover as we get started. Today's course is 2.25 hours. We are recording the training session. During today's class, the trainers are going to control the slides. If you want to control your own slides, we do have the option available for you to download the presentation. And in the related URLs on the middle right, if you go to the CLUIN training page, you're going to see a link where you can download the presentation. Throughout today's training, we are going to have questions and feedback from you. You are welcome to type in a question or a comment anytime in the Q&A box in the bottom right. At the question and answer breaks, we're going to ask some of those questions out loud, and if you're on the phone line, you're welcome to ask questions out loud as well. At the end of the class, we do have a feedback form. We do ask that you fill out the feedback. It is something that we use as we improve this class as well as offer new training classes. Something that is available only through the feedback right now is a confirmation of your participation. If you need a certificate to document your participation today, it is available through the feedback form. So you finish class, fill out the feedback form. At the end, there's a box to check to certify that you attended. Once you submit the feedback, that's going to generate a certificate for you. So it's only through the feedback that this is available now. More information about ITRC is on the website, which is www.itrcweb.org. ITRC is made up of members from state government, the private sector, stakeholders, our federal partners, Department of Defense, Department of Energy, and EPA, as well as members from academia. And you can see a pie chart here that this is how the risk team was made up. And this is pretty typical of how ITRC teams are made up. We have a wide variety of participants working together to create information that's of use for you. The full version of the ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted. More information is available on the ITRC website. You can see the wide variety of technical and regulatory guidance documents that are available. The training schedule for the rest of this year is available, and we're also working on our schedule for 2017 and hope to have that out within the next several weeks. On slide 5, I'll introduce you to the trainers. All trainers were members of the ITRC Risk Assessment Team. That team was led by John McVeigh of the South Dakota Petroleum Release Compensation Fund and Claudio Sorrentino of the California Department of Toxic Substances Control. Diana Marquez is an associate toxicologist with Burns & McDonald in Kansas City, Missouri. She has over 20 years of risk assessment experience and has worked with a wide variety of sites under CERCLA, RCRA, and state-led programs. Barry Selko is usually our second trainer, but she's unavailable today, and special thanks to Emily Strake for filling in. Vivek Matroni is a staff toxicologist in the Human and Ecological Risk Office at the California Department of Toxic Substance Controls in Berkeley. He provides human health risk assessment and toxicology support to the department's Brownfields and Environmental Restoration Program and Safer Consumer Products Program. Kevin Long is a senior manager at Ramble Environ in the Princeton, New Jersey office. He applies risk assessment and risk management strategies to support site characterization, risk management, and redevelopment at hazardous waste and brownfield sites. Emily Strake is a consultant with Langen Engineering and Environmental Services in Warrenton, Pennsylvania. She provides technical expertise in the areas of risk assessment and environmental chemistry and has worked assessing chemical data and the potential adverse health effects to humans from exposure to hazardous contaminants. On slide 6, I'll now turn today's presentation over to Diana Marquez at Burns & McDonald.
Thank you, Juliana. So we're good morning, everybody, or good afternoon, depending on where you are. And we're going to start off today's presentation with a poll question. And what we're asking is, how much knowledge and experience do you have with risk assessments where you're using site-specific information rather than just relying on default values and lookup tables? So what do you mean by default values and lookup tables? What we're talking about there are basic numbers that you can either find in guidance documents or that are available on a published basis rather than something that's calculated or developed specific to a site. So I'll give you guys a couple of seconds to sort of answer the question. And it looks like, as information is coming through, quite a few people do have some experience with some site-specific evaluations in at least a limited way. There are quite a few of you who have not had much experience in a site-specific way, although a handful of you have done quite a bit of it. So we have a good range of experience, which will be great, because I think you'll find for all of you that you'll find something useful in this training as we go forward. So why did we decide to develop a guidance? I'm sure many of you are sitting there thinking, there's 1,000 risk assessment guidance in the world. Why did we think another one was necessary? Well, risk assessment is widely used for decision making. It's widely accepted in many agencies across the country. And it can be very complex, especially when you start getting into site-specific evaluations. And when looking at risk assessments, the real decision makers on a site can often find themselves faced with very complicated issues and technical scenarios that require quite a bit of professional judgment. And they often find themselves uncomfortable with making some of the professional decisions and applying judgment in situations that are not necessarily always very clear-cut. And oftentimes, that lack of comfort can result in defaulting back to, for lack of a better word, default scenarios. And that may or may not always be the best decision for an individual site. So when we got together on this risk assessment team, we thought it would be very useful to develop a guidance document that really focused in on non-standard scenarios, non-default approaches that people encounter when developing and reviewing risk assessments. So when you're reviewing risk assessments or working with them, the types of questions you probably encounter are running into situations that just don't fit the default approach. When looking at a lookup table, for example, you will often see a standard industrial scenario or a standard residential scenario. But what happens if you're looking at a site that's agricultural in use? I'm located in the Midwest. Agricultural land use is very common, and that's not often considered in lookup tables. Or what if you're reviewing a risk assessment that has equations or assumptions that you don't recognize that aren't necessarily in your state's guidance document? You may start questioning the validity or the defensibility of some of these calculations. So hopefully this guidance document, our intent in developing it was to really help to address some of these types of non-standard scenarios. So one thing to point out very early on, both in this training and early on when you start looking at this guidance, is that it is not a how-to document. It's not your traditional risk assessment guidance document. You should not open this document and expect to start at the beginning and finish at the end and be able to complete a risk assessment by the end of it. That's not how it's organized, and that's not the intent of its development. It really focuses on specific technical issues and is organized in that manner. So when you look at it, consider it more of a resource, as a very topics-driven resource, and that's how it's best used. So for every particular topic that we identified, it's organized around various options for how to resolve that particular issue or topic. And when we use the word options in this guidance, we could be talking about alternatives or recommendations. In some cases, we're talking about solutions. We chose the word option in our writing of this document as sort of a generic term to cover all of those different types of results. So when might you use this document? Like I've said, it really is intended to address the non-standard situations that you might not encounter in the traditional or your normal guidance documents. The example that we have on the slide is when you're dealing, for instance, with off-site groundwater receptors, and you may not necessarily be able to sample on those particular properties, or like I mentioned earlier, an agricultural land use scenario that may not be covered in a guidance document, or a recreational scenario, or various situations that simply aren't necessarily commonly covered. Some of the examples, for instance, that were in the initial poll that Juliana had laid out might be dealing with institutional controls or various, assumptions like that. I think one of the commenters had put in there that bioavailability was something that they had encountered that they don't often find addressed in guidance documents. Different non-standard scenarios. So how can this guidance, how can it help you? Well, it's really designed to help a couple of different groups of people in a couple of different ways. If you're a project manager, this guidance document can help you really be a more informed consumer of risk assessments. It can help give you the additional confidence to spot some misapplications and mistakes in how risk assessments can be done. And hopefully it will help you review whether or not values and equations are really applied and selected appropriately. And ultimately, hopefully it will help you understand some of the language of risk assessment. Us risk assessors can often get into our own jargon, and you can often find that reading a risk assessment may seem like you're reading a foreign language, and hopefully this guidance document can help you interpret some of that. As a risk assessor, this guidance kind of presents a one-stop shop for information that can often, you may have to sort through many, many different guidance documents to pull bits and pieces of. We've tried to consolidate it all into one place, or at least a lot of it into one place. It could help you translate information or make your work easier and more easily understood to a wider audience, and hopefully help you make some decisions or give you some guidance or direction in addressing some situations that you may not necessarily encounter on a regular, everyday basis. So what are we going to talk about today? Well, the first thing we're going to touch on, and very, very briefly touch on, is just a general overview of risk assessment in the cleanup process in general. And this is a very generalized overview. And then we're going to dive right into some of the issues that we've identified and some of the options that we've identified in the various risk assessment subject areas. And then we'll have a wrap-up at the end where we actually talk about good suggested ways for using the document itself. You're going to find that this particular graphic is going to show up repeatedly throughout this presentation. And this graphic is really intended to illustrate how the risk assessment process itself really fits into risk management as a whole. And it shows the interrelationship between risk communication, risk assessment, risk management, the importance of stakeholder engagement, and it also illustrates the different steps of the risk assessment process. What you'll find is this: the guidance document, as well as today's training, is organized into the various steps of the risk assessment process. So keeping this graphic and keeping this organization in mind will help you focus on how everything is going to flow as we go through the training today. So chapter one is, as I said, it's a very generalized overview of what is risk assessment. Again, this isn't intended to teach you how to do a risk assessment. It's just to sort of give everybody a basic overview so that everyone's sort of starting from a basic fundamental understanding of what it is. So you'll see this equation repeated a couple of times throughout this training as well. The basic fundamental principle that risk equals the combination of toxicity and exposure, and that in order to have risk, you have to have both toxicity and exposure. And there are aspects, issues that can require site-specific evaluation in each step of this process. So chapter two delves into uses of risk assessment in site cleanups. And it really focuses on two specific areas. How best to tailor a risk assessment to suit the specific needs of a project. And in this regard, you want to think about questions such as, what is the goal of your risk assessment? How complex is your site? And really, how best can your goals be achieved? When you look at these basic questions, this can really help you tailor your risk assessment and focus on the approach, which leads us into the next question in Chapter 2, which is, what approach should you use? There are several different options that you can take in designing your risk assessment. You could do a baseline risk assessment. You have the choice of going a forward versus a backward risk assessment. You could take a tiered approach, and you have the options of deterministic versus probabilistic approaches. And we'll dive into those a little bit as we go forward here. So what is a baseline risk assessment? A baseline risk assessment is kind of exactly what it sounds like. It's an evaluation of the risks caused by a release, and this is in the absence of any actions to control or mitigate the exposure. So this is what you do to quantify the risks under a baseline condition. So in other words, there's no institutional controls, no land use controls, no engineering controls. It assumes that exposure, any exposures could occur to the baseline situation of a site. This can be very helpful in determining whether or not a remediation is needed, whether or not an institutional control might be needed, whether or not an engineering control might be needed. Baseline risk assessments are helpful in making these sorts of upfront decisions when you're evaluating what kind of a remedial scenario might be useful. Another question that you might ask is what could be more beneficial to you, a forward risk assessment versus a backwards risk assessment? And what does that mean? Well, risk assessments, a forward risk assessment, this is what we would consider a traditional risk assessment, where you're starting with a concentration of a chemical in a medium, like say soil. You look at the concentration in the soil, you look at the dose to a receptor, you look at the toxicity, and at the end of your calculation, you come up with a calculated risk number. So you're going forwards through the process. A backwards risk assessment goes the opposite direction. You're starting with an allowable level of risk, then you're evaluating the toxicity and the exposure to come up with an allowable concentration of a chemical in a medium. Now, either one of these accomplishes the same goal. It gives you, in the sense that it gives you a risk estimate and a concentration in a medium, it's just that the endpoints differ. Are you starting with a known concentration in a medium and you want to know what your risk is, or are you starting with a known risk point and do you want to know what your allowable concentration is in your medium is? So depending on what question you're trying to answer will help dictate whether you'll best get there going forwards versus backwards. Another option is to do a tiered approach, taking a tiered approach to a risk assessment. Now, the advantage to a tiered approach is it allows you to sort of go upwards in complexity, and as data becomes available and as may be necessary. For example, a tier one risk assessment tends to be very generic, non-site specific. They typically are low in cost. However, there's generally a lot more uncertainty associated with it. You may not have a lot of data collection needs. Data collection needs may not be high. And you may have a little bit higher cost of remediation because of the higher uncertainty amount, a level of uncertainty, and the fact that it's not terribly site-specific. Now, I'm going to qualify that by saying that the cost of remediation being higher is not always the case, but it is often the case. As you go up towards Tier 2, you start getting progressively more site-specific from Tier 2 to Tier 3, which means the cost of your risk assessment starts getting progressively more expensive, but the level of uncertainty starts going down, and theoretically, the cost of your remediation potentially starts going down as well. So in this regard, you have to weigh the data needs, because your data needs, as you start getting more going up in tier, also start going up as well. You have to start weighing the cost of your risk assessment with the decrease in uncertainty and the potential decrease in remediation. The last real major decision you're going to make at this early stage is really deterministic versus probabilistic. What does that mean? Deterministic basically means that you're using a single value for every input parameter, and at the end of the calculations, you end up with a single number for a result. So you're putting in a single chemical concentration, a single value for each of your exposure parameters, and you're going to end up with a single risk number at the end. A probabilistic risk assessment basically means you're using distributions of input values. So your exposure parameters may be missed based on ranges. And your results at the end of the day are also result in a range. And this can allow you to better understand your level of uncertainty associated with each of those numbers. Now, there's advantages and disadvantages to each one of these approaches. A deterministic risk assessment can be much easier to understand because it's one number. One number is fairly easy to understand, fairly easy to explain. However, you don't necessarily have the best understanding of what the level of uncertainty is that's built into that number. You can qualitatively talk about the uncertainty, but you don't really have a great, really good, concrete grasp of what it is. A probabilistic risk assessment may be harder to explain to people. It's a little bit harder to wrap your mind around what that range of results really means and how to apply it, but you do have a much better grasp and a much better understanding in a much more concrete manner of what the uncertainties are in that number and in that range of numbers, rather. So each one of those carries its advantages and disadvantages. I guess the last that I would throw out there is that a deterministic risk assessment is the most commonly done. It's what most people do, so therefore it's also the most easily and most commonly accepted. A probabilistic risk assessment is less frequently done. It's less well understood and can be a lot more difficult to have accepted and get approvals through. So with that, I'm going to pass this over to Emily, who's covering for Barry, and she's going to talk about project planning. Emily?
Thank you, Diana. All right, we're going to discuss project planning and its role in risk assessment. The chapter is generally organized around three issues, scoping and technical approach, which is meant to ensure that the risk assessment is fit for purpose, the purpose it's intended for, the conceptual site model, and data and information. Planning ahead of risk assessment should be thorough, and information and data needs for the risk assessment need to be defined up front. That includes whether alternate approaches to defaults are needed or even allowed. The left side of the figure here shows a framework for human health risk assessment designed by EPA, and it recommends that stakeholders provide input to all of the phases of a project from the initial planning stage all the way to the decision-making stage. And you can see at the top of the figure, the planning and scoping stage includes developing a conceptual site model and a sampling and analysis plan. Those would be based on the needs of the risk assessment. The risk assessment, again, like I said previously, should be fit for purpose and inform the decisions that the agency project manager needs to make. So we're coming up on a poll question here. Have you worked on a project where stakeholders were engaged only after the risk assessment was written, and so addressing their concerns caused major risk assessment rewrites? And we'll see some answers come in. There's some blessed few that are answering no, some yeses a few times. I can comment that this is really so important to engage all the stakeholders up front, so that there is concurrence on major issues and you don't have to rework a risk assessment at the end. Still seeing some results trickling in, but again, the majority, I think, are saying yes a few times, yes almost every time, a little under half are answering no. So figuring out the appropriate resources for the risk assessment are is really an essential activity that requires stakeholder engagement. A stakeholder is anyone with an interest or anyone who could be affected by the decisions that are being made as a result of the risk assessment. Examples might include the local community and Native American tribes. Stakeholders are much more likely to accept risk management decisions that they participated in shaping. And the process could provide valuable information regarding things like unanticipated exposure scenarios, for example. Communicating during planning and implementation is critically important. It's really a best practice to engage your resources and other stakeholders in the beginning of a project and throughout the life of a project. So it's an ongoing process. Risk assessors can provide valuable input throughout in regards to scope, approach, potential exposure scenarios, data needs, and the development of cleanup goals if necessary. The photo is of a project planning session for a site in Puerto Rico. The EPA project manager and risk assessor representatives from Puerto Rico and their contracted risk assessor, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, national level and local level individuals, and responsible party project manager, their risk assessor, all met at the site and walked the area to talk about potential exposure scenarios, define exposure areas, and that led to identifying data needs for the risk assessment. This type of project communication is really the gold standard, which is often, unfortunately, not achieved. It's critically important to identify the regulatory jurisdiction and lead agency before risk assessment begins. The project manager also needs to identify and understand the regulations, policies, and policies are often written, they're oftentimes unwritten, and understand the guidance that's available under the applicable program. The program itself may affect the scope and assumptions of the risk assessment and how the risk estimates are interpreted for remedial action. For example, what is the acceptable cumulative cancer risk threshold under a specific program that may differ and it could result in different cleanups. We've probably all encountered a generic or inadequate conceptual site model that doesn't capture all the information for the project. So a site-specific CSM should be prepared during the planning stage and refined throughout as the project progresses. The conceptual site model can be used to determine things like what media are going to be sampled, the sampling locations based on the variety of exposure areas, what sampling depths are required based on types of exposure, those sorts of inputs. It's important to note that the CSM should be updated as new data is received and evaluated as well. So certain aspects of the risk assessment, like exposure scenarios, exposure points, or receptors could change, and the conceptual site model should reflect that. Coming up on another poll question. Reviewed a risk assessment where institutional controls or engineering controls were incorporated into the risk assessment. And so far, the majority of people are responding yes, both IC and EC. And many states and programs have guidance on this issue. Regulations may or may not allow IC or EC, or unrestricted use may be a goal, which would limit the use of IC or EC. Again, looks like most people have reviewed a risk assessment that incorporated IC and EC. So during planning, we need to decide whether or not to include institutional controls, engineering controls, or consider a remedial action that's already been planned. If you're preparing a baseline risk assessment that would not consider implementation of new ICs or ECs, and you calculate acceptable levels of risk, there would be no further action necessary. But following that, in cases where the regulatory context does allow it, you might consider incorporating ICs or ECs to evaluate potential future scenarios, like what is the risk under a specific land use control? What is the residual risk if an area of a site is excavated? Also, I'd like to mention that there's an ITRC team preparing a guidance document for ICs. It's called Long-Term Contaminant Management Using Institutional Control. This is an example site in Illinois with waste residue piles from a former smelter. The tractor trailer in the background provides some sense of scale for the size of the waste piles. And during the planning phase, future land use uses were discussed, and the agency project manager in this case decided that residential land use wasn't likely and that the risk assessment should only address industrial use. And here we have an example from a site in Wisconsin. Institutional controls currently exist that prohibit wading, swimming, and fishing. And during the planning stage, the IC was discussed, and the possibility of ignoring the institutional control for the risk assessment and even the need for the institutional control to begin with was questioned and evaluated. You know, does the notice here, the sign, need to be here? Is it health protective? Ultimately, the agency project manager decided not to incorporate the institutional control in the risk assessment in this case. So the project team is often asked if the data are adequate for the risk assessment, and it's the project planning team that needs to identify the risk assessment data needs during the planning phase and define what are your data quality objectives during preparation of your quality assurance project plan previous to the risk assessment. The EPA data quality objective process and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers technical project planning processes are just two examples of systematic planning that you can use to plan your data collection for a particular site. The team should think about various aspects of the data set when you're determining adequacy, like the media, available concentration ranges, how many samples you might need to collect, where your samples are going to be collected in relation to source areas, specific analytes and their associated reporting limits, and the age of the data itself. The next example is a site in Illinois. For this site, a site visit by the agency project manager and risk assessor and the responsible party project manager and risk assessor took place during the planning stage. And here they looked for sediment deposition areas, access points for receptors, obvious exposure areas, and whether edible-sized fish were present in that waterway for consumption. And this information was used to identify the data needs for the risk assessment, like sediment samples from depositional areas close to the receptors, and surface water samples from areas near receptors as well. Some of the additional issues addressed in Chapter 3 are listed here, like assessing hotspots, recognizing biases, addressing background concentrations, just to name a few. And we're up to Chapter 4, which is data evaluation. This chapter is generally organized around five issues, including data gaps, data usability, data reduction, data visualization and analysis, data screening, and chemical selection. The chapter also provides information regarding potential alternative approaches to regulatory default assumptions. Often we have data gaps that need to be identified. If a data gap exists, you could first consider if that lack or absence of data will even change the results of the risk assessment. And then if it does, plan to collect more data to address the gap. There is always going to be an uncertainty in the sampling efforts and the risk assessment itself, and you can't sample every particle of soil and perfectly characterize a site. So the key is to figure out if the uncertainty represents a significant data gap that could change the results of the risk assessment or not. This is a site in Maryland, and for this site, there's an adjacent site that's impacted the park through airborne deposition. And so during the planning stage, it was decided to collect both incremental and discrete samples throughout the property. No samples were collected near the center of the site. You can see a gap in the yellow dots, which represent discrete soil samples. and there were none collected in the center of the property. But there's a concentration gradient that's away from the source. So this is not considered a significant data gap. That's because having more low concentration data near the center of the site wouldn't change any of the conclusions of the risk assessment. So sometimes there are permanent data gaps, and these are gaps that won't be and can't be filled during the project, and they're going to ultimately result in missing information. There are some ways to overcome and address permanent data gaps, including making educated estimates regarding concentration, using a different area as a surrogate exposure area, using past professional experience from a similar site, or simply making a conservative risk management decision. Frequently, we see that only text and tables are prepared for risk assessment, but data visualization tools can be really useful in revealing site-specific data patterns that wouldn't otherwise be apparent. There are multiple tools that could be used and document, and the document presents a variety of different types of data visualization tools and describes the pros and cons associated with each one. This figure is a probability plot, and it's often called a QQ plot, and it was developed using the EPA's ProUCL statistical software package. The benefits of presenting data with a QQ plot include being able to really easily identify outliers in the data. On the right side of the figure, you can see a potential outlier, and you can see the distribution of the data. Some of the cons for this type of presentation are that you can't match these specific points to a corresponding sample location, and the concentrations aren't provided. And another limitation is that it doesn't provide any temporal information. This is a two-dimensional map that shows where sampling locations and concentrations are in relation to one another and where the maximum detected concentrations are located. What we can't see from a 2D map is how concentrations of chemicals may be changing over time, or if all the samples were collected during the same time frame. So you're missing that temporal component. Identifying appropriate screening levels for a project is a really important step. You need the screening levels to be conservative enough that risk drivers for the site, receptors, and the various scenarios wouldn't be overlooked. That's the most important thing, is to identify your risk drivers. Screening levels will be different with various scenario settings, and it's important to remember that they do not necessarily represent cleanup numbers. The planning team needs to talk about, figure out what will be done if the screening levels or the exposure scenarios change over the life of a project, and at what stages the screening levels would be reevaluated if changes are identified. This is an example site in Illinois, and here the conceptual site model was used to identify appropriate conservative screening levels for the site. We have a situation where local residents could be exposed to surface water and sediment during wading into this stream, but the water is too shallow for swimming. There aren't any edible fish, and the water is not used for drinking water. So in this case, the project managers elected to use residential soil and tapware RSLs. Those are the EPA regional screening levels for screening data. The EPA also has a RSL calculator that lets you calculate a site-specific screening level for surface water or sediment, and that could have also been used in this case. So some of the additional issues presented in Chapter 4 are data usability, data reduction, and the screening of data, chemical selection process, among other things. And now Vivek Mathrani with the California DTSC will present Chapter 5.
Thanks so much, Emily. Well, Emily gave us a nice walkthrough of some of the considerations in planning a risk assessment and who you need to engage and what sites you might need to consider. And also she presented some issues on data gathering and visualization as well. So moving forward over the next three sections of this training, we're going to talk about the elements of a risk characterization, that is the actual quantitation of human health risk or hazard. I'm going to be talking about toxicity over here, being one of the toxicologists on the team. So just a reminder, we will be reminding you over and over that risk is a function of toxicity and exposure, where toxicity is the characterization of what the chemical's health effects are and what is the relationship between exposure and those health effects. Just remember that just like with anything that gets quantitated, there's an inherent uncertainty in it. In regard to what a chemical's health effects are, remember that those endpoints might be identified from epidemiological studies or occupational studies or extrapolated from animal studies or sometimes even from a petri dish in an in vitro study. And that entails its own uncertainty that would affect your uncertainty and risk. And then remember that the relationship between exposure and health effects is often determined in a laboratory setting, formerly known as a dose response curve. And the figure over here shows several continuous curves where the intersection with the y-axis at zero represents a threshold below which that concentration presents no adverse health effect. Even though these are depicted as continuous smooth curves, let's remember that in reality, these curves are informed by just a few data points, maybe four or five data points at different dosages, and that these curves are fitted to those data and extrapolated to a low-dose scenario to come up with a toxicity value. Obviously, most risk assessors won't have the onus of deriving these toxicity values. Usually you would look them up either through IRIS or through a state database, but it's important to understand that oftentimes these toxicity values from these dose response curves are approximated at an upper confidence limit to provide a health protective value for risk assessment. And I'll just point to the lower left that there is an appendix in our guidance document in addition to Chapter 5, the toxicity chapter, that goes into a little bit more detail on the derivation of these toxicity values. In this training, I'll be touching upon three issues. One, that toxicity values may be selected from multiple sources, and I'll be using tetrachloroethylene as an example. Also, toxicity values are reassessed and updated, and I'll talk about trichloroethylene. And also, a toxicity value may not be adopted or established immediately, and I'll use total petroleum hydrocarbons as that example. And just to turn your attention to the table below, it's an excerpt from the US EPA regional screening levels table. I just wanted to highlight, using the three examples that I'll be touching upon later on in this chapter presentation, that it's one source where you can get toxicity values. You can see the columns marked SFO or IUR. Those are the cancer-based toxicity values for an oral slope factor and inhalation unit risk, respectively. And also there's a reference dose and reference concentration, which pertain to non-cancer endpoints. So here we'll talk about sources of toxicity values. And the issue is, how do you choose one from multiple sources out there? But two questions we need to ask ourselves when generating a risk assessment are whether that toxicity value is going to give us an adequate protection of human health, and also when we submit a draft risk assessment for review to an oversight regulatory agency, is that regulatory agency going to accept that assessment as health protective and good for decision making? So here's a few options for picking a toxicity value. One is you can use 2003 U.S. EPA guidance, which divides up into three different tiers. Tier one selection is U.S. EPA's Integrated Risk Information System that most of you know as IRIS. A second tier selection is U.S. EPA's PPRTV, the Provisional Peer Review Toxicity Values. Those are provisional values that have not undergone SRP review, scientific review panel review through IRIS, but it's a provisional value that you may be able to consult the U.S. EPA toxicologist on. And tier three are other sources, of course, that may be additional U.S. EPA and non-use U.S. EPA sources, including toxicity values prepared by states and other agencies. Another option is using that the same U.S. EPA guidance, the 2003 guidance, in and supplement it with 2007 Environmental Council of the States guidance. You could also use state agency toxicity or values or their own hierarchies. And I'll just touch upon for tetrachloroethylene, TCE, when IRIS reviewed tetrachloroethylene and came up with updated cancer toxicity values, the state of California did not adopt those values since they were less stringent. The IRIS values were less stringent. The state of California wanted to stay with the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessments values as more health protective for use of risk assessments in California. And there's always the option of consulting experts in toxicology, and I'll address that later on. This brings us to a poll question. Do you use the hierarchy of toxicity values in your risk assessments? And I see as the responses come in that a lot of you are pretty consistent with always using the hierarchy, and an equal amount are say that it depends. And the only thing I'll caution is it's important to have clarity within your organization and with your oversight agency as to what hierarchy you're using. You know, to avoid the scenario that you're passing a draft risk assessment back and forth and there's a dispute over what toxicity value is appropriate for decision making in the risk assessment. What to do when a toxicity value is updated? Several of you who work on vapor intrusion sites may recall that the non-cancer toxicity value for trichloroethylene was developed by IRIS in late 2011. So in the state of California, we were using a reference concentration for trichloroethylene of 600 micrograms per meter cubed. Then US EPA publishes in late 2011 a reference concentration of 2 micrograms per meter cubed. Obviously, that's a relative protectiveness of 300-fold. The 2 is 300-fold more conservative than 600 that we were using in California. So what were the implications of this? Not only was it a reference concentration for long-term exposure, but it was also identified as an accelerated response action level because the health endpoint that was identified for that reference concentration was a narrow developmental window for fetal cardiac malformations. So it was only over the course of a few weeks or even maybe a few days. The thing is, as an accelerated response action level, risk managers in our program who oftentimes thought, hey, we're always looking at chronic exposure and lifetime cancer risk, and we have the luxury of time, and you know, we can worry about it when exposure is approaching 30 years. This was no longer the case because it was a response action level, a short-term level. And risk managers who were using the 10 to the minus 5 lifetime cancer risk were slowly realizing that this is already, that 10 to the minus 5 risk is already more than twofold over that accelerated response action level. So obviously, this gave a new decision criterion for vapor intrusion risk management in that when trichloroethylene was a contaminant of concern under vapor intrusion scenarios, right, we have to look at short-term exposure as well and short-term hazard. No longer were we in that position to feel comfortable just looking at long-term risk. Another issue that we encounter sometimes is what happens when a toxicity value is unavailable. This is coming up a lot when we're looking at perfluoroalkylated substances, and that there's about 4,000 perfluoroalkylated substances out there, but we're only starting to develop tox criteria for a couple of them that have been historically used in consumer products and in aqueous film-forming foams, and yet we don't know whether they're representative of the rest of the class. But first, let's determine if the value is actually needed to guide a risk management decision. So if you have a contaminant where you don't have an identified toxicity value, you can question, is that contaminant co-located with another hazard that needs to be addressed anyway, like in soil? And if you're going to dig up that soil for one contaminant, you're already getting rid of that other contaminant for which you don't have a toxicity value. Also ask, is the exposure pathway significant? Look at your conceptual site model. Verify if you have a volatile or what the fate and transport is of that contaminant, and whether there's a hypothetical exposure associated with the presence of that contaminant on the site. Other options for unavailable toxicity values are using a surrogate value intended for a different time frame. So if you have a subchronic value, you can use it as a surrogate for a chronic value. Or switch up the exposure routes. I mean, sometimes for some chemicals, the oral pathway is used as a surrogate for inhalation. And another option that people are slowly becoming aware of is the resource of the Superfund Health Risk Technical Support Center. This is the center with the EPA that helps identify a value and develop a PPRTV. They can help identify a surrogate chemical, and for instance, with a TPH risk assessment, benzene was selected as a surrogate for low-range aromatic TPHs, and depending where you are, where you're placed as a stakeholder, this could be a good thing or a bad thing. If you value protection of human health at all costs is important, a conservative assumption of using benzene as a surrogate may be appropriate. But then on the other hand, if there's a cost incurrent that a responsible party has to take up, this might be a little bit, it might be perceived as going too far, whereas is it appropriate to use benzene as a surrogate? And that's part of the dialogue that needs to happen when discussing what the appropriate toxicity value for a cleanup needs to be or a remediation needs to be. There you see the contact information for the Health Risk Technical Support Center. So I'd encourage you, if you do come to this issue, that you see them as a resource. There are additional toxicity issues in Chapter 5 that are not covered in this training, having to do with the toxicity of chemical groups and mixtures, looking at mutagenic carcinogens. We have a section on addressing the toxicity of lead, and we do have an appendix that addresses understanding the uncertainty and toxicity values. And once again, I'll reiterate that we do have two appendices on toxicity, including one that is a pretty comprehensive list of sources of toxicity values in the guidance in addition to Chapter 5. And with that, that takes us to a Q&A session, and I'll hand it back to Juliana.
Thanks, Vivek. We are going to have time now for questions. Before we get to those questions, I do want to remind you, at the end of the training class, we do look for everyone on the call to fill out the feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide in the feedback. It's also a way for you to create a certificate for yourself. So you complete the feedback form. At the bottom, you check the box to certify you attended, and the system is going to generate a certificate of participation for you. So right now, the only way to get that is through the feedback form. On our last slide, we're going to have a link to the feedback form. If you leave before we wrap up, in the related URLs, that fourth item down is the feedback. You select the name, and then you look down a bit. You select Browse To. That's going to open that feedback form. We do appreciate if you take just a few minutes at the end of the class to give us your feedback. We have a question that's come in. Can this guidance be used area-wide multiple contaminant sites impacting the groundwater aquifers and potential impacts to public drinking water well fields?
This is Emily. I had posted a response to this, and I'll just reiterate what I said, which is the guidance document does discuss fate and transport modeling, which may be necessary to determine potential impacts to groundwater sampling techniques and considerations for sampling groundwater or potential soil impacts to groundwater, but it doesn't specifically include a discussion of any forensics and associated techniques that would be needed to assign a legal responsibility for an area-wide impacted public drinking water supply.
This is Juliana. I will mention on November 3, we have our class on environmental molecular diagnostics, new tools for better decisions. So the person asking this question may be interested in that class. Registration is available on the ITRC website. And at the end of the training, you can go to the links page, and that also will send you back to the CLUIN where you can sign up for upcoming classes. Do we have any questions from the phone line audience? Remember, #6 to unmute your line. At this point, we don't have any other questions that have come in online, so we'll go ahead and move on to the second half of the training class. This hopefully will allow some more time at the end of the training for additional questions if those come in. Remember, you are welcome to send in questions anytime throughout the presentation, comments as well if you would like to, and in some cases we will respond right back to you using that Q&A pod. For now, we'll continue on, and I'm going to turn the presentation over to Kevin Long from Ramble Environ. Kevin?
Thanks, Juliana. So in the next couple of slides, we're going to start dealing with issues associated with the performance of the exposure assessment, of the risk assessment. And just to kind of piggyback off of what our earlier presenters have talked about, is this, this is the general equation that we've been touching on. Vivek just talked about the aspects of toxicology that are embedded in the evaluation of risk. What I'm going to be dealing with over the next couple of slides deal with aspects that are a component of assessing the degree of exposure. And we're defining exposure as, how people come in contact with chemicals in the environment, but then also how do we go about quantifying, the degree of that contact, the magnitude of that contact, how frequent, how long, and over what period of time. So there are a number of issues that this chapter addresses, each of which has options for solving them in the performance of the exposure assessment. I'm going to cover a couple of these as we go forward, but I would really encourage you checking out the document and specifically this chapter for issues that might be of interest to you as you work on your projects or review risk assessments that you are you have that responsibility for. So the first issue that I'm going to touch on deals with elements associated with something that we commonly call exposure areas or exposure units. And that is an issue in which exposure areas or units are not often representative of the actual exposure patterns of the receptors that we're interested in. In some cases, you might find that they're based on hypothetical default exposure areas or perhaps even operational units or areas of concern, things like the boundaries of a solid waste management unit, for instance. So just out of curiosity, just want to check the audience. Have either prepared or reviewed a risk assessment where the area or unit of exposure was arbitrary. Kind of lets folks respond and see what we end up getting. So I think it's just, the response is generally consistent with what we saw as a team. We have a little bit more saying yes, but generally speaking, I think we see a lot of examples where there are risk assessments that are performed that rely on what we might characterize as arbitrary boundaries of exposure. And there's good reason for that. In a lot of cases, it's somewhat difficult to establish the exposure areas. But if you kind of keep the following in mind, and specifically that it really should be the combination of the receptor's activity and the media of exposure that should formulate the exposure area or unit that we're interested in evaluating exposure within. Different receptors are going to have different activities. And as a result of those different activities, they're going to have different exposure areas, ideally. And it's important to maintain consistency between how we're calculating things like exposure concentrations for those individual receptors and their exposure patterns in order to make sure that our risk assessment is able to adequately answer the questions that we have to be able to have it answer so that the risk managers can actually make decisions that are informed. So a couple of options for dealing with this potential issue. One option is to rely on what is known or anticipated about a particular site. As Emily talked about earlier on in the presentation, when you're planning the risk assessment, a very key component, which is obviously something that I think many of you probably have embedded in not only just doing risk assessments, but the investigation of potentially contaminated sites, is to build a conceptual site model. And a part of that conceptual site model is taking into consideration scenarios for potential human exposure, but not only what human exposure might be today, but also what it might be in the future. So we might have information that tells us about either the current state or the future state of a particular property. Is it being redeveloped? How is it being redeveloped? What are the boundaries of the areas of a particular site, and what are the activities that we would expect inside those areas? Understanding what is known or what is anticipated about a particular site can be a really powerful tool for risk assessors to think about in establishing the boundaries of these exposure units so that they're not arbitrary. Another approach that can be very valuable and useful is something that the guidance document talks about it refers to it as point-by-point risk calculations. To give you a sort of an impression of what this entails, envision a particular site that is being investigated. The example that's on the screen, all the little circles represent a soil sampling location, and all the polygons that are around it represent what is, at least on this project, used to characterize the extent over which each of those soil sampling locations is presumed to characterize. And what was done on this situation was risks were actually calculated at each location under the assumption that the receptor, whether it was a resident or a potential vapor intrusion exposure, all occurred as if the exposure was entirely within that one area. So essentially the activity pattern was presumed, conservatively and hypothetically, to occur entirely within that small polygon. And the risks were performed. Now, what this does is it gives sort of powerful information that can make this question or this issue a lot simpler to address. And what I mean by that is risk assessments that are done in this form or in this way, even at the beginning, can allow you to screen out very large areas potentially of a particular site. So in the case of this example, you can see all the white space are basically areas where the risks posed by the contamination or the concentrations observed at those locations do not result in potentially unacceptable risks. So what that does is it minimizes the difficulty or the challenge that I would have as a risk assessor in thinking about what the exposure areas should be. So I can focus my questioning or thinking around just the areas where I identify polygons with potentially unacceptable risk. And then perform additional analyses to think about what the likelihood would be if we made assumptions about likely exposure areas. So in this case, just as an example, a hypothetical residential parcel, say about a quarter acre, so then we can evaluate exposure within that hypothetical area. So it's a very efficient tool for making the approach for answering and addressing this issue a lot simpler, or at least minimizing the amount of decisions that we have to make. Shifting gears a little bit towards another component of the exposure assessment, and that deals with the establishment of exposure factors, and in particular, the justification of site-specific exposure factors. On a lot of cases, you might experience the need to perform risk assessments or review risk assessments for exposures that are not routinely encountered. And in such cases, there may not be what we might refer to as default exposure factors for those individual receptors. So again, just another quick poll. Curious, are they prepared? or reviewed risk assessments, which involved the evaluation of exposures for which you didn't have default exposure factors, either provided by the agency or something readily available that you could hold on to or point to as a basis for the assumptions in your risk assessment. Okay. Yeah, and okay, so the responses are coming back. Again, very, very much consistent with what our team identified during our discussions. And that is that it's very often that we as risk assessors or even risk managers are challenged with having to evaluate potential exposures when for exposure scenarios or for types of exposure that are not routinely encountered. So one of the options that's presented in the guidance for dealing with this specific problem is to utilize probabilistic exposure assessment as a tool. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go through an example of how you could potentially apply this to justify site-specific exposure factors for a particular exposure scenario. Okay, so in order to do this, I'm going to rely on an exposure that actually is something that we're probably routinely used to considering, and that is drinking water exposure. This is an equation that we would use to evaluate the dose or the amount of exposure that someone might incur through drinking water exposure. So there's an ingestion rate, an exposure frequency, an exposure duration, and a body weight. All of those are parameters that we would use in calculating the dose. And all of those values, if we ideally were going to do a deterministic risk assessment, going back to what Diana had talked about before, would be individual values that we would plug into this equation. Now, for this young lady, that would be very easy. We could just ask her, how much water does she drink a day? Unfortunately, when we're doing risk assessments, we have to take into consideration the variability of the population or the receptors that we're charged with helping to assess exposure to. So the way in which we might need to answer the questions about what numbers to place into those values, we can go and rely on information that's actually publicly available. Examples are, for example, the exposure factors handbook that USEPA has maintained. In guidances and in references like this, you can find information regarding the variability of potential exposure for any particular exposure scenario. The example table that's on the screen right now is an actual table from the exposure factors handbook. It's information and data that was compiled by USEPA for, in this case, how much water or the variability in water ingestion during various recreational activities like boating or rowing or kayaking, fishing. And it gives you some sense of how much variability there is. You know, what's the mean, what's the upper confidence limit of that mean? And it gives you the ability to understand the variability of, in this case, the ingestion rate during recreational activities. Well, like that other table, there's a table in this in the guidance that provides a lot of detailed data on ingestion rates for drinking water exposure for adults in the United States. Well, we can take this information and we can actually build distributions or histograms of each of the parameters. So the ingestion rate, I can build a distribution for that, exposure frequency, exposure duration. Again, I can build these distributions that are more representative of the population that I'm interested in. Now, you might be asking, you know, where is this all going? Well, what I can do is I can combine those distributions into a calculation and actually get an overall distribution of the dose, if you remember the equation that I had presented earlier. So the graphic that's at the bottom is really the distribution of exposure for drinking water of my receptor population. Now, one of the things that we can do is we can actually also account for how various agencies define the exposure to which we have to protect for when we're doing risk assessments. You might have heard in the past the term reasonable maximum exposure, and that's something that is actually defined by the agency as an amount of exposure that is within a realistic range, but it's still a conservative assumption or estimate of the degree of exposure. And in this case, the EPA has commonly defined that exposure somewhere between, say, the 90th and 98th percentile. So what that allows me to do is recognizing the exposure that I need to assume or utilize in my risk assessment, I can then look at the individual values that I've assumed for each of my parameters, say, the exposure duration or the exposure frequency, and the eventual number that I might plug into my discrete calculation and check to see if my distribution supports the individual values that I might use for any of these parameters as justifiable in my risk assessment. So the approach here that I've described is one where if you do select an individual exposure factor and someone challenges you on it, why are you using 2 milliliters per day for this exposure scenario? Well, this is an exercise that you can use to justify or feel more comfortable about the outcome. In this case, these individual exposure factors result in a dose that actually falls just outside what might be considered the reasonable maximum exposure. So what that means is I can feel comfortable in using an exposure frequency for my residential population of 350 days per year, as an example. So again, this is a tool or a technique that you can use for any given scenario where you have the available information, where you can build these types of distributions and do these calculations to be able to justify an individual value that you might use in your risk assessments, exposure assessment. All right, so shifting gears again, I'm going to talk a little bit about another element of the exposure assessment, and that deals with exposure concentrations. And more importantly, one of the key issues that we are faced with is that we have to utilize, in many cases, fate and transport models to evaluate exposure. In these cases, a lot of the models that we rely on are conservative by design, and for good reason. They might presume an infinite source mass, or they might assume no contaminant attenuation between the source and the receptor. So there's a lot of assumptions that are embedded in the models that we commonly use because, one, we can do them quickly. Two, they don't require a whole lot of verification or justification. And we can have confidence that what we're getting out of them can be very useful in making risk management decisions. But one consequence is they tend to result in outcomes that may be more conservative than necessary for us to make a good, strong decision, and especially one that is protective. So there are options for evaluating or addressing this potential issue. And that is, for example, using what the guidance refers to as a mass balance check. Now, in this case, the scenario would probably require or could potentially require trade-offs in the sense of it might require additional data be collected in the field to be able to demonstrate or to document what the extent of contamination was. To try to give you a better visualization of what I'm talking about here, I'm going to use a sort of a simple cartoon. Imagine a situation in which you had a contaminated soil source, and you were charged with evaluating potential exposure in a drinking water well that was presumed to be immediately down gradient of this contaminated soil source. So you're using a relatively simple fate and transport model to predict a concentration in the well and subsequently the degree of exposure that might occur. Well, one of the things that you can do after doing that modeling, especially if you've got good information regarding the degree or the total mass in your soil volume, is to check whether the mass of contamination that you're predicting your receptors exposed to over the exposure period, whether that mass of exposure exceeds the mass in your original source over the exposure period. So it gives you a nice way to check whether your fate and transport model would result in my person being exposed to more chemical mass than actually existed in the environment to begin with. And that's a very nice check on these fate and transport models. Obviously, the theoretical maximum exposure would not be able to exceed the total amount of mass that you have present in your environmental space here. An additional aspect here is accounting for uncertainty. Again, this is still related to exposure concentrations. When we do risk assessments, ideally, the concentration that we're presuming our individuals or our receptors are exposed to is intended, in most cases, to be the average or the average site-related concentrations. And that is because we're trying to simulate what the concentration is that our receptors coming in contact with over their exposure period. A lot of times we do have the benefit of using actual monitoring data to be able to understand what that average is. But the actual arithmetic mean of that data may not be a defensible estimate of the true average concentration. So one of the techniques or one of the options that's available to us is to use essentially apply statistics in a way that we can calculate upper confidence limits on that mean. Now, this technique is very commonly used. I'm sure probably many of you have experience with using ProUCL, for instance, to come up with estimates of upper confidence limits on the mean. And what this does is it gives us a conservative estimate of the actual average, but it accounts for our uncertainty, given the fact that we have limited information. So to give you an example, this is a hypothetical exposure area. Presume that the numbers that are presented here in the dots represent sampling locations and the concentrations observed at each of those locations. Overall, my goal, my objective, is to, for my receptor, the exposure area is defined, is to think about and to determine what is the average concentration inside this area. Now, I can look at the data. I can do histograms to try to get a sense of how does my data vary. I can calculate the arithmetic mean. I can calculate percentiles of that data. So in this case, about 95% of the data falls below about 86 milligrams per kilogram. And I can calculate an upper confidence limit on the mean. So what that really is given the data that I have here, I am 95% comfortable and confident that my average concentration, my true mean, falls somewhere below 58 milligrams per kilogram. Now, one of the things to point out is that if I had the benefit or the opportunity of collecting more data, let's presume that I did take the opportunity to do that. Well, and I reconsidered and replotted my information. Well, my histogram slightly changes. My arithmetic mean drops slightly from 25 to 21. The percentile actually drops, again, slightly from about 85 to 78. But more importantly, my upper confidence limit on the mean drops a lot. And the reason it drops a lot is because I'm now less uncertain about my true mean because I have more numbers. I have more data. I have a more robust sample population. So to link back to what I had said originally, we use upper confidence limits or calculate upper confidence limits on the mean because it gives us something that we can rely on that gives us some sense of the uncertainty in our data. And more importantly, I think it's a very useful tool in thinking about and capturing that uncertainty when we do risk assessments. Another approach is to utilize other techniques like area-weighted averages or what some agencies refer to as spatially weighted averages. Now, these are also very effective techniques in calculating or estimating average concentrations in exposure areas. They're probably most appropriate when you have situations in which your data is unevenly distributed between sampling locations within your exposure area. When we calculate UCLs on the mean, for instance, a lot of cases, like the example I said before, there's a certain presumption that each of the individual locations is essentially characterized the same amount of area within our exposure unit. So when we work on projects where we've biased the sampling programs towards areas where we suspect or expect to find higher concentrations, which I suspect is techniques that you guys commonly use when you're evaluating and exploring and investigating contaminated sites, we are presented with this challenge. Now, one of the things, just to give you an illustration of what I'm talking about, same example area, if we were to do this calculation, we can use techniques to try to calculate or predict the area over which each of the samples is presumed to characterize, and then use that information to calculate the average concentration to which our receptor would be exposed to over the exposure period. So obviously, samples that characterize large areas have a larger weight than those that characterize smaller areas. Now, one of the things that is not captured here on this slide is the fact that our area-weighted average here does not account for our uncertainty. So we already get a concentration here of about 9.5 milligrams per kilogram. Comparing that to the original UCL and the mean that I calculated, you can obviously see a significant difference. But one of the things that's not captured on this slide, but the guidance document does discuss, is calculating an upper confidence limit on the area-weighted average. And it's a technique that the guidance suggests considering, especially in cases where you need to account for the uncertainty in your data. And it's something that I would encourage you to check out. So again, these are the issues that the guidance deals with for this chapter, the exposure assessment chapter. Hope you find it to be very useful. I think there's a lot of very good information in there, particularly on how to address some of the challenges. I think somebody had raised the specter of bioavailability. That is something that is out there and discussed in this guidance. I would encourage you to check it out. I'm going to shift now back to Emily, who's going to take us through the next component of the guidance, which deals with the risk characterization aspect of the risk assessment.
Thank you, Kevin. So as we've seen previously in the training, risk characterization is the combination of the information from the exposure and the toxicity assessments. And it really provides the basis for the risk calculations going forward. The results of the risk characterization really quantitatively support our overall conclusions about risk and help us answer the question, what is the potential of developing a health effect for people that are exposed to a chemical under specified conditions? And we're going to spend some time on the presentation of risk results because one issue that project managers frequently encounter is risk results that are difficult to interpret. Risk assessors should take care to present the risk results in an organized, systemic type of fashion so that project managers can make risk management decisions. Some of the most important information the risk assessment should communicate is which chemicals and pathways contribute the most to risk or risk drivers. This helps to identify remedies to reduce or address that risk. Risk characterization also provides a qualitative or sometimes a quantitative understanding of the uncertainties and bias that are inherent in every risk assessment. And we want to provide this context to the risk results in order to support the risk assessment's conclusion. So when you're presenting the risk results generally, you should include the risk for each chemical, risk for each exposure route, for example, risk from ingestion, risk by each individual medium, and total risk, like risk from soil exposure combined with risk from groundwater exposure for all of the receptors and chemicals. We're going to walk through a hypothetical construction worker evaluation and the presentation of risk results for this receptor. We have a future construction scenario for a project that couldn't involve construction of roadways or buildings. And so for this example, the construction worker could come into contact with soil, and we happen to have an elevated water table in certain areas of the site. So construction workers could also be exposed to chemicals in groundwater. Are chemicals of potential concern at this hypothetical site are arsenic and benzoapyrene for both soil and groundwater. And in this example, we've chosen to focus the risk assessment on just those two chemicals rather than evaluating every detected chemical at the property. We've identified or potentially complete exposure pathways for the construction worker. And they include incidental ingestion of soil, dermal exposure to soil, and dermal exposure to groundwater. And there may be other relevant exposure pathways, but we're not going to cover them in this example. So first, we need to provide risk results for each chemical by exposure route. Here we're showing the calculated risk results for arsenic from incidental ingestion of soil, taking the RME soil concentration in combination with our exposure assumptions for the construction worker, we could calculate an average daily dose for non-cancer hazards. The ratio of the average daily dose to the oral reference dose gives us the hazard quotient, or HQ, which in this case is 0.02. Similarly, for carcinogenic risk, we've calculated a lifetime average daily dose, and we've multiplied that with the cancer slope factor to calculate an incremental cancer risk for ingestion of arsenic in soil, and that's 1 times 10 to the negative 7th. This type of table allows the project manager to see a stepwise presentation of the risk and hazard calculations and the toxicity values that were selected for each chemical as well. The presentation of results should include risk by each route of exposure. So in these tables, we can see risk attributable to soil ingestion and dermal exposure for each chemical. We can easily find the hazard quotient and excess cancer risk columns and verify the individual calculations if we're reviewing the risk assessment that would be necessary to do. And we can compare the results to whatever our regulatory thresholds may be. In this case, let's say the maximum allowable excess cancer risk is 1 times 10 to the negative 6th. We can see that arsenic and benzoapyrene are both below that level for ingestion and dermal exposure to soil. After we've calculated risk and hazards for each route of exposure, we can sum those for each medium and present total risk by medium. In this example, we might conclude that soil isn't a concern for the construction worker because the combination of all the soil pathways, incidental ingestion, and dermal contact with soil, we still have a non-cancer hazard index below the threshold level of 1 at 0.02. And similarly, the cumulative cancer risk is less than 1 times 10 to the negative 6. But if you look at groundwater, we can see that the hazard quotient for arsenic is acceptable, but the incremental cancer risks associated with dermal exposure to groundwater for arsenic and benzoapyrene, they're the shaded cells here, they each exceed 1 times 10 to the negative 6. So that could indicate a potentially unacceptable risk. And finally, we want to include a presentation of the total risk and hazard for the construction worker. So we have both of our chemicals for the site, and all exposure pathways represented in this single table. We calculate a cumulative cancer risk by summing all of the individual excess cancer risks for soil and groundwater, and we calculate a hazard index by summing all of the individual hazard quotients. As we sum across the columns for arsenic, we have 1 times 10 to the negative 7th for soil ingestion, plus 1 times 10 to the negative 8th for dermal exposure to soil, adding to that 5 times 10 to the negative 5th for dermal exposure to groundwater. And the result is simply expressed as 5 times 10 to the negative 5th due to the differences in magnitude. And after we complete the same process for benzoapyrene, we can calculate a total risk for the construction worker. In this case, it's 7 times 10 to the negative 5th. So the risk assessor and project manager might take a look at this and conclude that the construction worker should be protected from dermal contact with groundwater. And this might include requiring PPE or some other barrier in areas where you have an exposed water table. Another issue that you could run into during risk characterization is whether to keep the default agency assumptions, which are generally less representative of conditions at a site than a site-specific alternative might be. So Appendix D of the guidance document is a summary table of common default assumptions used in risk assessment and a presentation of some alternate assumptions that could be used to reduce uncertainty or reduce bias while still remaining conservative. Some of the topics covered in the appendix include choosing an exposure point concentration, whether or not to account for background, whether or not residential use represents a reasonable future land use, among many other topics. So I just mentioned accounting for background. If we look at this USGS map, which provides a detailed evaluation of regional background arsenic concentrations in groundwater in the United States, remember that the default is to assume that all detected concentrations of arsenic in groundwater are related to some activity that took place at the site. But you may have an option to evaluate the background contribution to site concentrations, which could be really useful information for project managers. So we'll return to our hypothetical construction worker scenario. And we look again at the total risk summary table, except now we have the risk attributable to regional background arsenic levels shown. And in this case, the background contribution to the hazard index is 0.08, and the background contribution to total cancer risk is 3 times 10 to the negative 5th. If we subtract those from total risk, we can calculate a site risk that doesn't account for that or doesn't include that background contribution. And in this case, we still have a total cancer risk greater than 1 times 10 to the negative 6th at 4 times 10 to the negative 5th. So we have a poll question regarding uncertainty. Have you ever reviewed a risk assessment with a generic or incomplete uncertainty section? And I'm seeing mostly yeses. I think there's a lot of copy-paste going on. Unfortunately, this is really common, and generic uncertainty sections don't contribute much towards understanding the results of a risk assessment or whatever potential biases those uncertainties could impart on the conclusions of the risk assessment. Still, a vast majority of responses are yes. So we're going to start with some basic definitions. Uncertainty is defined as a lack of knowledge about the accuracy of the risk results, how close to the numbers we came up with, to the, quote, true risks. And uncertainty can also refer to an unknown amount of variability that would surround a specific value or input. And if that value will over or underestimate risk. For example, is the exposure frequency 120 days or 200 days per year? And if you select one versus the other, what are the impacts? To prevent underestimating risk, using conservative assumptions that are health protective of receptors is usually the way of dealing with uncertainty. In effect, we're using bias to shift all the risk estimates in a more conservative direction. Sometimes risk assessments don't include enough information to evaluate the uncertainty and bias in the results. The risk assessment should include a detailed consideration of the toxicological assumptions that were made, particularly in the case when there are adjustments made to specific toxicity values, or other site-specific issues that require more information, like the use of surrogate chemicals when there's a lack of a toxicity value for a chemical of interest. The risk assessor should also provide information about the uncertainty and bias in the exposure assumptions. This could be including issues related to sampling methods, like the collection of discrete samples or composite samples, the selection of an exposure point concentration, perhaps that's a UCL or maximum concentration or another alternative. Another option could be to include multiple descriptors of risk in addition to the reasonable maximum, like the central tendency level of exposure, which is an average level of exposure, or risk for important and sensitive subgroups like children could be presented. Additional information can be found in Chapter 7 regarding summation of risk results, probabilistic risk assessment, and a number of resources and tools that are listed here that can be useful in calculating screening levels, calculating risk. So we're going to talk a little bit about risk management, and that's Chapter 8. Risk management is the process of identifying, evaluating, selecting, and implementing actions with the overall goal of reducing risk. We're not going to go into all the issues associated with risk management, but some things that you might need to consider are scientific factors like toxicology, analytical chemistry, the public policy of state or federal agencies can have a really big role. And so does the professional judgment of risk assessors, geologists, and other professionals involved in the assessment, and those involved in making risk management decisions. You may need to think about social, political, or economic concerns in risk management as well. Poll question. Have the land use assumptions for your projects ever changed after the risk assessment was completed? And I think this frequently occurs in redevelopment projects, brownfields, often when the future land use may not be definitive or known. This is a relatively frequent occurrence and can have a major impact on risk management and risk assessment. We're pretty split. I think, though, a majority is still going to yes a few times or yes overall. It does happen, and when it does, you need to evaluate the impacts. So risk assessment, it's constantly evolving, and so state and federal guidance is also continually changing in response to that. And as we just saw with the poll results, the reasonable future land uses for site can change during the life of a project. And generally, you want to use the most current information that's available to you to make risk management decisions. So to do this, project managers need to have an ongoing communication with risk assessors to talk about changes that affect a risk assessment and whatever impact that they could have on the conclusions and the recommendations that were made. For example, if you have a site that is an idled refinery and future land use now includes possible commercial redevelopment, that information needs to be communicated and accounted for in the risk assessment. The risk assessment may also need to be updated as time goes by to account for changes in science. This could be a qualitative discussion of the effect of a change or a semi-quantitative evaluation of the impacts with a focus on the issues that could affect a specific risk management decision. Or it might not be necessary to update a risk assessment. Maybe an exposure parameter or toxicity value was updated, but it doesn't make the risk assessment less protective. If the values are made less conservative or they're relaxed, like a reduced exposure duration, then the current risk assessment will still be health protective. This decision would need to be made on a case-by-case basis, given that risk assessments impact remedy decisions. Uncertainty in numerical risk estimates. There may be times when we need more than a qualitative discussion to really fully address uncertainty in the risk estimates. And a probabilistic uncertainty evaluation might be used in that case. So here we have an example. It's from EPA's risk assessment guidance for Superfund. And the graph presents three cases where a different combination of estimates of the RME value for ingestion rate and exposure duration were used. So for cases 1 through 3, both the ingestion rate and the maximum exposure duration were successively increased, and you can see risk increase with each increase in ingestion rate and exposure duration across the three cases moving left to right. The results here provide an estimate of the risk distribution when you account for these two sources of uncertainty. You can see that the 95th percentile risk range is between 7 times 10 to the negative 6th for case 1 and 3.5 times 10 to the negative 5th for case 3. So if the level of concern for your project is 1 times 10 to the negative 6th, all cases would lead the project manager to the same conclusion, that risk is above that level. But if the level of concern is 1 times 10 to the negative 5th, then case 1 indicates acceptable risk, but cases 2 and 3 do not. So this allows you to visualize the effect of these different assumptions and the impact that they might have on a risk management decision. And other issues that are addressed in Chapter 8 include risk management in project planning and other factors in risk management, like the use of guidance, applying sustainability, facilitating stakeholder acceptance, and resources and tools. And now Kevin Long with Ramble is going to talk about risk communication.
Thanks, Em. So the next chapter, as Emily mentioned, deals with another aspect of risk assessment and risk management, particularly in how it's used, and it deals with risk communication. Overall, our goal is to help all stakeholders have as good of an understanding for how the risk assessment can be used and how it supports decision-making, particularly risk management decision-making. The risk communication process has to be iterative in order to allow it to help to inform how the risk assessment is performed and how the risk management decisions are to be made. So overall, it's an incredibly important element, and it's significantly interwoven in the performance of a risk assessment. So a couple of issues are raised and dealt with in the guidance. I'm going to talk about a couple of them here. One is related to risk perception and how risk perception and interpretation create challenges. Challenges for the project at large, if you will. And one of the options that is discussed in detail in the guidance is being aware of and addressing as much as possible differences in how people perceive the risks. Now, overall, we have to keep in mind that risk perception is really something that's subjective. And, it's based on the qualitative personal views of individuals. But that subjective context is just as important as how we quantify or even our perception of that quantified risk. And we cannot underestimate how important and how valid the issue of risk perception is when making risk management decisions and when preparing and developing and communicating the results of risk assessments. Now, for me personally, I'm an individual who, at least for a long period of time, was extremely afraid of swimming with sharks, for instance, even though my risks are significantly less relative to other hazards, such as being exposed to the sun and incurring skin cancer in my lifetime. So that is almost entirely driven by my risk perception. Now, what's involved with that? Well, if you think about numerical risk estimates, the way people perceive or interpret the numerical risk estimates, which are really in many cases the product of our risk assessments, depends on whether the issue is something that the individual is exposed to or threatened with in a voluntary or involuntary way. Does it represent a dreaded or catastrophic event? So for me, the acute hazard of being attacked by a shark is significantly more scary to me than being subject to skin cancer. Although I'm not saying that's necessarily how everyone would perceive the risks or react to those risk estimates. Your personal context is very important. Considerations of fairness and equity, control of the issue. Does an individual stakeholder have any degree of control over the decision-making process? How familiar are they with the problem? Many of us, we probably work, maybe even live in and around or somewhat familiar with contaminated sites. So we have a degree of familiarity with the nature of those sites and the types of issues that come with those types of sites. So we may be more comfortable with those issues. I can tell you for sure my mother would not be, because she's just not as familiar with those types of issues that come around or come along with these types of sites. So a degree of familiarity is important. And lastly, the trust in the institution or the industry that might be delivering the message, might be presenting the information. Trust is a substantial element in how risk communication needs to be performed. Again, it all gets back to how people perceive the message, how people perceive the information, and that degree of trust plays a significant role. Now, another issue or another option is looking at using effective communication methods to try to address this potential issue. One of the aspects that's presented in the guidance document comes from fairly classic guidance on how to perform risk assessment. The citation at the bottom there is a 1998 document that talks about something that the agency referred to as the 7 cardinal rules of risk communication. And they're relatively common sense, but important to point out. Issues or approaches such as accepting the public as a partner in the process can be extremely helpful. Being open and honest about information. Attempting to, take into consideration concerns or feedback from the public that can be incorporated into the risk assessment process. Planning and carefully laying out the efforts can be extremely important. And also one additional tool could be to coordinate or even collaborate with other credible sources. Maybe that's an agency that you're working with or a local public interest group. Another issue that's discussed in the guidance is trying to find effective presentation strategies. One of the options that's presented is a technique for developing an appropriate message for communication with the public as a resource. This technique is sometimes referred to as message mapping. It's a process, it's a tool. As someone who does risk communication, message mapping can be really helpful in preparing to do risk communication and in making sure the risk communication is useful, and that not only the deliverers of the message, but also the individuals who need to be able to understand the message and to understand what it means and how to react to it can be very helpful. And it's a seven-step process where it involves a lot of planning, thinking about who the stakeholders are, making sure you think through that, elicit or even brainstorm about what the individual stakeholder concerns might be, come up with common concerns, broad concerns that might impact a broad range of stakeholders, develop messages that you can use to address each of those common concerns, but more importantly, supporting information for those messages. So not just telling somebody something, but supporting it, backing it up, and explaining why that message is appropriate and is defensible. Test it, practice it, and then eventually plan for its delivery. This message mapping technique is talked about in some detail in the guidance document, and it can be a very, very helpful tool in thinking about the approaching risk communication, whether you're a risk assessor, whether you're a risk manager, or even a stakeholder who might be interested in participating and engaging in this process during the contaminated site investigation decision making. So now I'm going to turn it back to Diana, who's going to give us a little bit of a summary and a wrap up. But I would encourage you all to really check out the guidance and appreciate the opportunity today. Diana?
Thanks, Kevin. So the last thing we would like to go through here really is a quick walkthrough on how best to use the document. So as we've gone through the training today, you can see that the training was organized into really the different steps that you would walk through when doing a risk assessment. And the document is organized very similarly. So the contents, if you go into the website, there's a contents bar on the left side, and it's organized by chapter. And there is a chapter for each of the sections that we went through today during today's training session. Now, if you click on each of the chapters, each chapter is then organized by topic. So, for instance, the example that I have showing here on the screen is Chapter 4. So you'll see that there are general categories like data gaps, data usability, data reduction concerns, etc. And in each, you click on one of those topics, it then gets organized by individual issue. And if you were to click on a specific issue, then each issue then drills down into the different options for addressing or evaluating or dealing with that particular issue. So in this particular case, clicking on the handling non-detect concentrations goes into the two different options that we discuss here in the guidance document. So this organization method really allows you to use the web-based document as a reference tool. You can click on it, look specifically for whatever issue it is that you're trying to address in the risk assessment you're either reviewing or working on. You can find it specifically within the document and really just focus in your research on exactly what topic you're trying to evaluate. And that organization we find makes it very useful really as a good reference tool. There's also a glossary tab, so if you go through there and you find any subjects or anything that you're uncertain about in terms of definitions or what have you, you can quickly go to the glossary tab and look up various terminology. And so that's really the best way to use the document. So hopefully, as we've gone through today's training session, we've highlighted some of the challenges that both risk assessors and project managers can face as they walk through this risk assessment process. From things like variability between programs, complexity in sites, and really the various challenges in applying the risk assessment process to varying number of different situations and the wide variety of situations that you can encounter. These challenges can, we found, translate to a variety of different issues, and each of these issues can have one or more possible options for addressing them. And so our goal in developing this document was really to come up with a good, concise way of summarizing a number of these different issues and really mining the existing document, guidance documents and research that's out there to try to consolidate that information into a single place. So this document is organized into topic areas to make it easy to use. And it also provides, in addition to a number of specific issues and providing options for how to address them, we do provide a lot of reference sources and places that you can go to look up additional information on any of the topics that we're talking about. The format makes it easy to use. It's very, very useful for drilling down through what can quickly become a very dense and technically challenging topic. So you're not stuck having to start at the beginning and read your way to the end. You can really quickly just find exactly what you're looking for and go right to it. The document is available, and you can view it or download it at the itrcweb.org. And with that, I think I'm going to toss everything back over to Juliana for wrap-up.
Thank you, Diana. We're now ready to take questions. So if you would like to send in a question using that Q&A pod, you are welcome to. Phone line participants, you also have the option of unmuting your phone, #6 to unmute, and you can ask questions out loud. So jump in with a question when you're ready. I do want to point out to our links to additional resources. This is the path you can follow to download the presentation. In addition to what you've seen on the slides, there's more information available in the notes section of the download version. So if you would like to have this presentation available as a resource for you, it is available from our links page. We also include a link to the document that's the basis of the training, as well as other links that we've talked about during today's class. We also have the feedback form. We do look for everyone on the call today. Just to take a look, we really do use the information. We have a new feature now available. If you want a participation certificate, you can get that through filling out the feedback form. So at the bottom of the form, there's a checkbox to certify that you've attended. Once you submit, it's going to generate a certificate for you. So right now, the only way to get that certificate is by filling out the feedback form, and be sure to check that box at the bottom. So if you fill out the form, realize you forgot to check the box, just go back, fill out the form again, and be sure to check the box at the bottom so that you can generate a certificate for yourself if that's something you're interested in. And regardless if you're interested in a certificate or not, please fill out the feedback form. We really do use the information. We're developing new classes right now, and the feedback you provide is very helpful as we develop those new classes, as well as input to this training class. I've also opened a couple poll questions. And on the left, would you recommend site-specific risk assessment after hearing what you've heard during today's class? And thinking about projects that you're working on, in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance document? So we do have those up, and as people put in responses to those poll questions, they will be available for everyone to see. We now want to take some time for questions. So for our phone line audience, remember #6 to unmute. You're welcome to jump in with a question. Also, anyone is welcome to use that Q&A pod in the lower right to send in questions. We have questions that come in, and our trainers have answered these online, but I do want to ask questions out loud so everyone gets to hear the answers. At a river site, there was a lot of discussion about exposure due to swimming. At this person's site, there's currently no swimming, but once the river is cleaned up, swimming will be possible. But because it's an urban setting, there are accessibility issues to the water body that have nothing to do with the water and sediment quality. Have you dealt with stakeholders that have different ideas about the long-term exposure scenarios?
This is Emily. From my perspective, I think one of the most important things that you want to do is capture what the realistic exposure scenario is. And so if you're anticipating that residual chemicals, this is following cleanup, still exceed risk thresholds, then I think it would be necessary to evaluate that if it's possible for swimming to occur. However, if you know there are areas that aren't accessible, you may be able to tailor the evaluation to exclude those areas. But again, it's important to capture whatever is actually occurring rather than just dismiss swimming as impossible or impractical due to those limitations, whatever they may be.
Thank you. We had a question that came in back around slide 68. Was software used to calculate the Thiessen polygons?
Julian, this is Kevin. I can answer that. There's a lot of different packages that you can use to develop interpretation methods for, I guess, characterizing the nature and extent of chemicals. Thiessen polygons can be generated using software packages like ArcGIS. You can even draw them. Again, they're just perpendicular bisectors, so some people can do it by hand. But I think a lot of the proprietary tools that are out there, particularly the geospatial tools, have embedded utilities for doing things like Thiessen polygons. So at least in my experience, we've used tools like ArcGIS to generate that information.
And I want to put a plug in for a couple ITRC training classes. On November 15, we have a class coming up on groundwater statistics for environmental project managers, and they talk about tools in that class. We also have a new class with a new associated document coming out, and we're currently planning to offer that class in December. It's on geostatistics for remediation optimization. So look to ITRC for more information that may be of use for you in these topics. Do you have any questions from the phone line audience? Remember, #6 to unmute. You also need to unmute the phone at your location. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website, which is www.itrcweb.org. We're coming up on the time of year when we have a new team starting next year. There's a chance to join ITRC team, so I do encourage you to visit the ITRC website to see how you can become more involved in ITRC teams if that's something of interest for you. We don't have any more questions, so we'll go ahead and wrap up early today. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us. If you do have a question that you weren't able to get in, you're welcome to email that to me at training@itrcweb.org. You can respond to any of your reminder emails about this training class to get that email to me, and we'll follow up with trainers. If you haven't already, please take just a few minutes to give us your feedback. We really do use the information that you provide in the feedback. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.